Sunny, 63 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Sunday, looks like rain showers, high of 53. Now sunny, 53 in Racine, 50 Kenosha, 41 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so pleased that, once again, it's that time when we get to welcome into our studios a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage and Director of the Clausen Center. Author of After the Cold War, and someone who joins us once a month to offer his analysis and insight on events both here and abroad. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's always a pleasure and a tonic.
Great to have you here, and we have a whole long list of really, really interesting things to talk about. In some ways, what I'm most tempted to jump to is the notion of political chaos in Britain and political stability in Afghanistan, which is a sentence I never thought I would utter, at least the part about Afghanistan being stable. But we're going to get to that a little later. The real headline item, I think, probably in the minds of most in terms of recent developments, was the face-to-face conversation between President Obama and the president of Cuba, Raul Castro, which I understand from your blog is the first time since 1959 that the leader of the United States and the leader of Cuba engaged in any kind of face-to-face personal conversation. So
sit down probably before 1959 because Fujilcimo Batista, the longtime very brutal dictator of Cuba, was useful to the U.S., but President Eisenhower did not go out of his way to spend time with him.
Hmm.
It's not unprecedented, I'm confident, but it's certainly historic and a major move.
Yeah, and of course, the picture of those two presidents sitting in chairs side by side, engaging in what appeared to be perfectly cordial conversation, made headlines all around the world as well. First of all, say a word about the event within which this conversation took place, the Summit of the Americas. What is that event, and what was the significance of Cuba being part of it?
It's a two-decades-old exercise building on the rather substantial history of intergovernmental organization and cooperation, despite the sometimes heavy hand of Uncle Sam and the U.S. military in Latin America. It was set up 2 decades ago as an initiative of another Democratic president who wanted to make his mark in foreign policy, Bill Clinton, and Latin American nations. It reflected the extremely important and profound movement to democracy in a region in the 90s that had been defined overwhelmingly by often very brutal dictatorships, often run by the military. Bill Clinton deserves a lot of credit for greatly, strongly, and decisively supporting the effort. The first one was held in Miami, and they've been held every 3 or 4 years since. At the last one in Colombia, there was very strong sentiment expressed, and this was not the result of U.S. leadership, quite the reverse, for including Cuba, which had been excluded. The U.S. and Canada found themselves alone, being the only members of the Americas that were against it. And quite rightly, Cuba was included. The summit had been a way of underscoring the isolation of Cuba. Mm. But at this point, I certainly believe that it makes sense in terms of our national interests to try to cooperate with Cuba. Mm. And especially after the particularly hard line of the Bush administration, which I think was driven mainly by domestic political considerations, the large Cuban vote in Florida especially, and the highly anti-Castro nature of that refugee population. And I think it's all to the good that President Obama has returned to a more sophisticated, flexible approach. Mm.
Tell us what we know about their conversation. Was much of the nature of the actual content of it made public?
Not that I'm aware. I don't think so. I certainly hope not. I think it was largely a ceremonial meeting. It's Henry Kissinger liked to say that among many other things, that are useful to keep in mind, that the summit really should be the conclusion. It's like signing the deal. We're discussing CEOs off the air and the importance of modern corporate investment and power. All the hard work should be done when they get together. This, and that's right. In the case of Cuba and the U.S., the opportunities are very limited in terms of expanding current cooperation, but we're slowly, in humanitarian and economic-ish areas, we're slowly but surely expanding cooperation. This was not a meeting to sign an historic agreement. It was a meeting to show symbolically that both sides are interested in getting along better.
Hmm. We had a conversation on the morning show not too long about Cuba and about some of the dramatic changes which are afoot there. And it was a conversation with Professors Jeff Roberg and Penny Seymour, who had been there recently and have mm-hmm. been to Cuba a number of times over the years, or Cuba, as it is actually more properly termed. And I kept forgetting through the whole course of that conversation.
It's always good to have purists around.
I'm sure much to their consternation. But I appreciated not only learning that, but learning quite a lot about other facets of life in that small country. What do you foresee in terms of Cuba's future now that they are, in a sense, more open to the presence and cooperation of those around them, and an openness which is kind of going in both directions? Any idea how Cuba and life for its citizens might be changed by that?
I am not an expert on Cuba or on Latin America. That doesn't stop me from writing op-eds about it. Various faculty, including our friend Yuri Maltsev from economics, have gone to Cuba. Jeff is in political science. Penny is a neuroscientist. And I think people who have practical on-the-ground experience as well as more substantive expertise are really very valuable. It's important to keep in mind that the embargo has been in place since 1960, but it hasn't worked. Embargoes generally don't. There are very few exceptions. South Africa, the white apartheid regime, is one where an embargo really worked. In Cuba, it has not. So Cuba has been exposed especially to Canadian tourists and some investment from other countries. as is often the case in life, your most difficult challenge is yourself. Your worst enemy can be yourself if you're not careful. Waxing philosophical here, the practical hard point is that the commitment to communist ideology and commitment to self-indulgence, self-preservation, and power by this now geriatric elite has really left Cuba in a shambles. Cuba had the highest per capita income in terms of mean income in Latin America when the revolution succeeded in 1959. It was not a desperately poor country, quite the contrary. There was a tremendous concentration of the wealth at the top. There were tremendous inequities, and since there was a fair amount of wealth in the country, those inequities were particularly visible. There also is a long and ugly history of exploitation by the United States since we conquered Cuba in the Spanish-American War that doesn't mark me as some kind of leftist ideologue. It's a fact of life and something serious Americans should be aware of. Therefore, I think that in terms of contacts by people at the top, things aren't going to change dramatically for them. I think the iron control of the Castro brothers will be in place, at least for a while. But the average Cuban should start to do a lot better, and especially in terms of letting families communicate with each other, letting families visit one another. That terrible human tragedy very quickly is already being overcome, and that's all to the good.
Is there anything you can say about the Castro brothers? I mean, this President Castro versus his predecessor, who stepped down a few years ago, is it 7 or 8 or 9 years ago? I forget now when Fidel Castro stepped down, but is what's occurring in Cuba mostly because of Raul Castro's different perspective, or are sort of, in a sense, almost inevitable events just taking over?
I think it's more the latter. Iron control by a remarkably ruthless and effective secret police. Very skillful intelligence services. It's fascinating, given what's available in Cuba. But their intelligence service, including penetrating the United States government apparatus for decades, is quite remarkable, and a lesson, I think, in different ways to us. We can be very complacent, especially since the end of the Cold War. That iron control, I think, will not be changing dramatically in the foreseeable future. It is a geriatric regime. Fidel stepped down formally as president when he turned 85 years of age. Raul is younger. Back during the height of the Cold War, especially during the too exciting 1960s, there were glib comparisons, including in government and military circles, between the brothers Kennedy and the brothers Castro.
Yeah.
Raul was seen as very much his older brother's enforcer, rather humorless individual, a more limited individual than Fidel without his charismatic appeal. There have been no drastic reforms since Raul took over. In some ways, he's been more disciplined, in the sense that he's been much more interested in the details of administration and maintaining a strong grip on the military and the intelligence services, which he has directly overseen.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see what is ahead for the citizens of that really beautiful country. Let's shift our attention to a very different part of the world, to Great Britain. Of your recent blogs that I read, where I learned the most, I think, was in what you had to say about the upcoming general election in Great Britain in early May, I think May 7th.
Yes.
I just realized I've been completely asleep when it comes to the political landscape of England and the fact that what had been for a while a relatively stable two-party system has now kind of splintered into something that's much wilder and crazier. Describe that to our listeners, because I suspect some of our listeners are, like I, just not following this. And to what extent are we talking about a really dramatic reshaping of the political climate there?
Indeed, it is time you woke up, Professor Berg. It is, in terms of party structure, a big change. Britain has rightly been recognized and respected as a stable, not only extremely long-term, continuous representative government, effective respect for the rule of law as we understand it, and we get it from Britain, but also a stable two-party system. Labour and the Conservatives, until Labour started to rise dramatically after the First World War, before that, Liberals and Conservatives. Things are always more complicated than that, but it was such an admirable, apparently stable system that in 1950, the American Political Science Association formally adopted a resolution, these professors did, that we should adopt a British parliamentary system. Now, that reflected respect of Great Britain during their incredible leadership, especially when they were fighting as direct combatants alone for about a year in World War II. It also reflected intense partisanship and the tremendous turmoil of American politics, gridlock, and you know, downright vicious politics is certainly nothing new in our system. Those things all came together. The British did have a coalition government during the Great Depression, all three parties, Tories, Labour, and Liberals, and during the special challenges and great difficulties of World War II, to put it mildly, but they have not generally had coalitions, in contrast to the continent, and the political science professors also made that point. So much for what professors think what the world should be doing. But structurally, it is a big change. Long-term and major changes for the last few hundred years, at least, in Britain, generally are long-term rather than short-term. There has been long-term growth in the support for the Liberal Democrats, previously the Liberal Party, another related party, the Social Democrats. They merged in 1988 to form the Liberal Democrats. That liberal revival was visible slowly but surely from the 1960s. In fact, I wrote my PhD dissertation on that Liberal Party, so I do know something about the subject. Also, long-term, slowly, the Scottish and Welsh nationalists have developed. They've had their ups and downs, but long-term, there's been significant growth in support, and the Scottish National Party may well take over the Scottish parliamentary delegation, decimating Labour in the May general election. It is British in the sense that this is nothing new, but the current conservative liberal Democrat coalition is the first coalition since the terrible and challenging circumstances of depression and world war in the 20th century, and it looks like that's likely to become the norm. Long-term support for the two major parties has slowly but steadily eroded. Regional pressures are again an important part of history, going back to the great conflict that finally led to the accession of Scotland with England, the dominant region, and also Wales early in the 1700s. The coalition government has survived. There's been tremendous tension, but it looks like that's going to be the model for the future. For the first time, televised debates were held in Britain before the last general election in 2010. Among the three party leaders, and Nick Clegg, the head of the Liberal Democrats, turned out to be a great media star. And as with Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960, it shows the power of television to catapult somebody into great visibility directly with the nation as a whole. There's a complicated series of, I think, three debates involving different numbers of leaders, which the conservatives have insisted on, but the debate a couple of weeks ago included no less than seven parties. The conservatives or Tories, Labour, Liberal Democrats, Scottish Nationalists, Welsh Nationalists, the good old Green Party, and UKIP, UK Independence Party, which is seen as a threatening movement, a very demagogic leader, very much opposed to the European Union, very much opposed to immigration. A really ugly movement, and in some ways, I think, rightly described as a fascist movement, very intolerant movement, but very unlikely to be part of the next government. They've done extremely well in elections for the European Union, which are separate from the national elections, and they came in second to the conservatives ahead of everybody else, showing the British skepticism and, you know, embedded ambiguity about being a member of Europe. Mm. I do believe the system will survive. Nick Clegg was the big star in 2010. I'll think of her name. The leader of the Scottish National Party was the real media star
this time around. One thing I wanted to ask you about in the blog is that you I wasn't sure exactly.
Nicola Sturgeon. I think is the.
It was right
as
there.
As professors, we get absent-minded, and we pass these sweeping resolutions that don't really endure. And thank you for letting me talk at all.
Right. That's fine. I wanted to ask you what you meant when you talked about alienation being kind of at the heart of this, whatever we want to call it, political splintering in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Alienation in what respect? I mean, who's being alienated from whom or from
hostility,
what?
Hostility, the normal human condition of being hostile to your boss, to your work. If it gets really difficult, your closest personal partners and friends. Human existence involves a lot of friction, and people get hostile to each other.
Mm.
I mentioned Karl Marx because Marx got his important ideas in Britain, studying British politics. He was from Germany. He worked as a very, very skillful and effective war correspondent in the U.S. during our Civil War. But it was British class conflict, I believe, that really inspired him. And he is known for his emphasis on class, defining history, economics, defining history, and the communist revolution will succeed, finally, because that's the course history is going to take, for sure.
Hmm.
Karl was not too flexible. He was also hard to live with. He had a lot of faults. But we easily dismiss Marx now because not only representative government, thank God, but free markets are, to a remarkable degree, the global norm. And increasing concentrations of wealth, I believe we've been able to head off the socialist and communist left in this country and elsewhere, because the complex interplay between government and business, between the public interest and private interest, has undercut, in effect, the natural tendency, which Marx very accurately saw, of capital to concentrate and income differentials to grow.
Mm.
He is known for his emphasis on class and class conflict defining history, but he also emphasized alienation. Over time, any particular economic order will tend to lead to greater and greater alienation.
Mm.
And I don't think I'm misapplying that to say that he comes to mind when you see the British, of all people, turning away from their established party order and moving in lots of new directions.
Right. And I think what you're saying is people, to a large extent at least, they are motivated by discontent, dislike of other people with other perspectives and so on. That's, I think, what you're talking about in terms of a personal alienation that's going on there.
Which I think is facilitated by capitalism. It's not, I don't think I'm getting too academic, I hope not, at least for NPR, but affluence, prosperity, leisure time, the ability to do something besides struggle to work for a living and keep your family together and basic survival, that provides opportunities to examine other discontents, not self-indulgence necessarily, but the freedom to think about other things, your psychological well-being. We've got a full stomach, thank God. Not all Americans, but the vast majority. And if you don't have a full stomach, there are ways you can get one. We're that rich. Tremendous change in the human condition. But that's pretty new. Sigmund Freud, another important figure from a certain ethnic heritage who is widely rejected today, especially in academia, his, I think, basic concepts have become so pervasive we take them for granted, but also his first patients were people with money, almost exclusively at the beginning, very well-off Jewish women in Vienna who had the opportunity to examine their personal psychological needs. You know, enough of the population had enough money that you could look at other aspects of life. And I think a lot of our current conflicts, which relate to what Bill Clinton calls identity politics relate to this historical trend, which is defined by alienation.
Huh. Interesting. It's interesting.
You know, at least to me. I'm glad it is to you.
Right. It really is.
So I stuck that in as the last paragraph or two of the column for that reason.
Right. And you suggest that Americans should be paying attention to what's going on in Britain now because it's something that, I mean, probably to a certain extent is already happening here in our own politics.
Well, we have, I think because of the scale of our country, the sheer physical size, not just in physics and engineering, you know, size makes a difference in how you operate. We have such a large system, and we have had north-south differences, which were resolved with great difficulty, but were resolved. We have other regional differences, but in fact, those regional differences have been fading. And this country is so complicated, just in terms of scale, that we have an incentive to work things out. We haven't been like Britain. We've had important third parties, but the dynamic seems to be different. The two parties are able to absorb these other sentiments. Yeah. Tony Blair, now very unpopular, an extremely brilliant politician, extremely successful politician, and I think prime minister, he went to some lengths to accommodate Welsh and especially Scottish separatist sentiments. There are regional assemblies, but they don't really have a lot of independent financial authority from London. And I do think that's coming in the future. But this struggle to accommodate the regions has been going on for a long time.
Interesting. Let's turn our attention to a very different place. And I just find it highly ironic that on the one hand, you're writing about kind of this new instability in Great Britain, and at the same time, writing about much greater stability in the nation of Afghanistan, of all places, which for such a long time has been anything but stable in just about any respect. And much of the credit you give to Afghanistan's new president, Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, and what has he done that has made such a difference in his country?
Well, he's still pretty new. He's been willing to work with there were eight candidates originally. In the elections, there was a runoff election. He and his principal opponent, I think a man named Mohammed, were able to work out a unity government, which promises considerable stability in the central government. John Kerry, our hardworking Secretary of State, deserves a lot of credit. I mean, a lot of credit for getting them together. He has a history of working in the World Bank and international civil servant, what we used to refer to as a dedicated public servant in this country, and that personality and commitment is very different from Hamid Karzai, his predecessor, who became increasingly alienated, increasingly difficult, a real pain in the neck, very hostile to the U.S., even though the CIA, maybe partly because the CIA was regularly giving him bags of cash. This guy got very large bribes from our government. For good reasons, I believe, but became increasingly, perhaps because he's so cynical, increasingly difficult to deal with. This is the first peaceful, nonviolent, orderly transition in power in the history of Afghanistan, I believe, and really represents major progress.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Art Sear from Carthage College. This is his monthly visit to the morning show, offering his observations on all kinds of different matters, both here and abroad. We'll eventually get to the complicated field of Republican contenders for the presidency and, of course, the recent announcement by Hillary Clinton that she is indeed running for president herself.
There was some news about that.
Right. We're going to talk about minimum wage as well and some other things. I wanted to give you a chance to just say a quick word about someone I had not ever thought much about, and it's a place I don't think very much about, Singapore. You wrote recently about the death there of the longtime leader of Singapore, who had been in power, you tell us, for more than half a century.
Yes, like the Castro brothers.
Right, in some respects.
Lee Kuan Yew, in
fact. Right. And I also hadn't ever heard the term before, the Four Tigers, which refer to Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan. So four big players in that part of the world, although Japan and China, of course, are not among them. But Does that term, the Four Tigers, imply that these four entities have worked together, cooperated, and have been collectively a force to be reckoned with, or are they just four isolated instances of, or examples of economic success in this part of the world?
I think the latter is more true. They're not isolated by any means. In fact, Four Tigers refers to dynamic, very rapid economic growth, and that is trade-based, all four, in great contrast to this country and China. Even now, they depend heavily on foreign trade, and both Hong Kong and Singapore have had fascinating statistics where the volume of export and import activity is far greater than their technical gross domestic product. They're both city-states, and it really highlights the importance of trade. I believe the term came into vogue in the 1980s. Starting in the 1960s, all four of these relatively to very small countries started experiencing tremendous growth and really stood out, a sense of movement, strength and movement, which is what the image of the tiger implies, and often cleverness. China was an enormous power, but we were frozen in the Cold War into the 90s. Japan, starting at the end of the 60s, seemed to dominate the economic landscape in the Pacific and increasingly globally before they crashed in the end of the 80s and early 90s. And they're a very powerful nation. I believe we underestimate them, and I'm hoping to do more work with colleagues and students at the college on that point. When we're so involved with China, quite rightly, we really should be looking to the other countries in Asia. But it's important development separate from China and Japan.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel like I need to pay more attention to Singapore from this point on.
Yes, there's been, absolutely. There is, in the case of Taiwan and South Korea, there's interesting, their political circumstances have been very different, but there's been interesting de facto collaboration. And in the nature of capitalism and the tremendous potential of real capitalism, the countries are involved economically, but that hasn't generally been part of their national plan.
Hmm. I know you also made mention as well of a very recent address that was made by Mr. Putin, the leader of Russia, who's always generating interest and or controversy of one kind or another. And we're going to have your colleague, Professor Yuri Maltsov, on the morning program next week. So we'll be obviously talking very thoroughly about Mr. Putin.
And, he is from Russia.
Right. But I just wondered if you...
For those who haven't had the pleasure of his company heard him, I'm very glad you're having Professor Maltsov on. Thank you with emphasis. That's great.
Yeah. So, but what did you want to say about what Mr. Putin most recently had to say? You made mention of the fact that this is sort of a yearly event in which he kind of struts his stuff.
Yes. Carefully planned, choreographed, and it looks like it. Especially with his egomania, I'm confident he overestimates the degree to which he's really having a major impact on the public. However, he is personally very popular within Russia itself, with the average Russian, and I'm sure these extravagances have been one reason for that. They go on for great length. He, when he's really in a comfortable situation, has been known to speak at great length, like the Castro brothers and some, not a few, professors and other politicians. he is clearly on the defensive economically this year for the first time in a long time, I think since the challenges of the 90s, measured Russian economic production is actually shrinking. The dramatic fall in the drop of oil prices worldwide, since they're priced in dollars, I think has had a significant negative impact on Russia generally, especially regions well beyond Moscow. And this tremendous immigration of professionals who can get out of the country and the tremendous immigration of capital means that for all his strutting his stuff and all the clever moves, he's a very clever fellow and I think has outmaneuvered the U.S. in important ways in different areas, he's standing on top of a ramshackle economy And I can't believe that economic reality can be denied for too much longer.
Hmm.
I'm not anxious for him to go. I don't think we're going to get some kind of Thomas Jefferson when Putin fades from the scene. There's a real danger, not of a return to communism, but a far-right, militaristic, perhaps far more expansionist succession to Putin.
Hmm. Somebody's scarier than Putin. That's a really scary thing.
I don't want to be an alarmist, and right. I'm sure NPR listeners don't get alarmed, at least not by me. But the outbreak of our kind of law and democracy is still pretty far away in Russia.
Hmm.
But I do think the long-term trend's in our favor. I think the most likely course is some kind of muddling through.
Right. Well, as I said, we'll have Professor Yuri Maltsov on the program next Wednesday, actually, and we'll pursue this topic in great detail.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I'm going to make an effort personally to make sure that people know about that.
Very good. Let's talk about matters here on the domestic front. A couple different things we should be talking about. One of them, of course, is an already contentious group of Republicans vying to be the next nominee for president, and on the Democratic side, a lone figure at the moment, Hillary Rodham Clinton. First of all, what is your sense of the figures that have thus emerged on the Republican side?
They're very diverse. It'll be a big challenge to define. Each of them tried to define a distinctive position and really catch the public imagination. The fact that so many are running is actually testimony to the health of our democracy. It also means to me, and I'm no Washington insider, wheeler dealer, and I'm no politician, I'm just a professor, but it looks like an awful lot of very smart people beyond the obvious polls, and I can assure you there are huge amounts of money and very, very talented people, and people with surprisingly little talent circling around these candidates and giving them an awful lot of very smart people feel that this could be a really good Republican year. They're not ducking it. And I think of an awful lot of smart Democrats. The media doesn't emphasize that point, and the dominant media doesn't emphasize the point that a lot of Democrats are shying away from former Secretary and Senator Clinton, not because the Clinton machine is so overwhelming and not because they're so intimidated and not because she's inherently so great, but because an awful lot of smart people in the other party think it may not be a good year for Democrats.
Just like it wasn't 2 years ago.
That's right.
So, in a sense, you see those fortunes or lack of fortunes continuing, perhaps.
Yeah, in the presidential year, the last two congressional elections have not been good for Democrats. And the first time around, the president said, "I get your message." And the second time around, it seemed to me the president was a good deal more aloof. It's a very complicated challenge for Hillary Clinton. One thing I know for sure is I'm not very good at predicting the outcomes of presidential elections, but I try to come up with dimensions that are different from the dominant narratives in the media, and that's one that strikes me now.
One of the biggest topics of conversation and debate and discussion, and even the subject of demonstrations, has been the matter of minimum wage, and it has played out in a number of different arenas. And of course, it comes in the wake of the observation that's been made all over the place that wages in the United States have been remarkably stagnant for a long, long time. So are you surprised at all at these events and that some of the moves that certain companies appear to be making in terms of actually raising wages after such a long time when no one seemed to be the least bit interested in doing so?
It shows the political pressure. I agree with you. It's important. I think it's an exaggeration to say no one is interested. But wage, you're referring to the compensation of working people, and a lot of working people are very much interested in changing that. The decline of the union movement in the U.S., except in certain important sectors, craft unions especially, also service, and and white-collar unions. I think that's a factor. The fact that the average person is doing better. The average person is doing better over the long term. At the same time that these structures have declined, and the fact that management has lots of leverage compared to the decades from the 30s, certainly into the 70s. And it's been since about 1970 that this enormous differential between the people at the top and the rest of the workforce has become so profoundly dramatic, very much like the Gilded Age early in the 20th century. I think those are all factors. But it's shown in the political pressure and the fact that people like the mayor of Chicago are making that a priority at a time of considerable economic income challenges for the government in Chicago and the state, of course. The fact that so many politicians are picking up on this, Democrats making it a principal theme, and Republicans not emphasizing opposition in many cases, I think shows how important the movement is. It's long-term pressure that's built up.
Right. I guess that's what I was trying to say before, is that probably for a long time people have felt like the people who work at McDonald's, and especially the people themselves who work at McDonald's, don't make enough money. It would be nice if they made more money, but people have felt like that for a long, long time, and suddenly, it seems, out of nowhere, we have massive demonstrations and McDonald's announcing that they're going to be raising those wages. And and you see that as just long-time pressure that suddenly is bursting into public view. I guess I was just kind of wondering where this is coming from.
I think it's a whole combination of elements, which is probably why I was rambling in particular and answering you. It shows the importance of politics over economics, with rare exceptions, unless it's really an ideologue on the left, which means she or he is not really an economist. Economists will often become quite intense on the subject, saying that if you raise the minimum wage, like the sun rising, like clockwork, unemployment increases. That happens to be statistically true, but politics involves a good deal of passion and other sentiments beyond just looking at the numbers. If just looking at the numbers were all that counted, we'd have a lot more economists in elected office, even more accountants and actuaries would be running everything.
Right.
That's not how politics works.
Right.
And Rahm Emanuel, especially, who's a hard-eyed, corporate-friendly, very successful executive in his own right, the fact that the mayor of Chicago, who's not your kind of predictable liberal Democrat, the fact that he's embraced this shows how important the political pressure is. You're quite right. It relates to American sense of equity.
Right.
Working people are not suffering the way they suffered during the Gilded Age. I realize I'm privileged. I don't think I'm complacent. But it's not because of mass hunger and mass destitution in this country. But it's not fair. Americans, like our British friends, Americans really believe in fairness. You got to give her or him a fair shake. You got to be fair. You got to provide opportunity. And it really is contrary to this basic American sentiment.
Right. I guess what confused me there for a second was I was trying to figure out, I was maybe thinking about the term politics in the purest sense. And of course, what does politics have to do with McDonald's deciding to raise the wage which they're going to pay most of their employees?
Well, perhaps a better term would be public relations. McDonald's is challenged worldwide despite this incredible income base and asset base. They are under attack by all kinds of upstart companies.
Right.
Especially in this country. That's our genius.
Right. So in a sense, everything's about politics in the sense of what people think of you, and this is becoming more and more a matter of concern.
You should become a political scientist.
Oh, crazy!
It's starting to sound like one of us. But it's public relations and political calculation by the corporation. I'm sure.
Right. So it's not politicians. Politicians making those calculations. It's all. I mean, in other words, it's not just politicians who have to think about politics. It's also CEOs of companies like McDonald's.
Yeah, and politicians, if they last, they reflect us, and they're reflecting, I believe, strong public sentiment.
Right.
The McDonald's, as because of low wages and news stories that reporters increasingly have been seeking out, Northern McDonald's has become a target, and we all tend to follow each other, and I think a lot of the media follows each other. But McDonald's wants to improve their image, and by doing this, they can make more money, which is what they're really interested in.
Right. And, of course, Walmart is another company, among others.
Yes.
I wish I had a more comprehensive list. I mentioned to you before you went on the air, there was an interesting story in the Tribune just this morning, I think, from a day or two ago. A Seattle CEO voluntarily took a pay cut in his own salary. It's a relatively small company in Seattle that processes credit card payments and orders and so on. And he announced to his employees this week that he would take a pay cut in his own salary, which would allow all of the employees of that company to make a base salary of $70,000 or more. I mean, willingly took that pay cut in order to make that possible. And that headline leapt out at me because, of course, that's in such stark contrast to what seems to be the reality in 99 out of 100 companies right now, with extremely large amounts of money being made by CEOs at the very, very top. And that continues to bewilder me that can be allowed to be in place for such a long time. I just don't understand how people stand for that.
Our colleague Mark Miller in business, who has a lot of practical business experience, as we were walking to lunch the other day, cited a study he had been reading that, in fact, the ratio between CEOs and workers has gone down in recent years. There's increasing shareholder and board pressure. I'm with you. It's wrong. It's obscene. It's also counterproductive. One reason why Peter Drucker, the great management guru, remains very popular, not in business schools, which shun him, the MBA factories, but real working people, older and younger, of all kinds, but especially if you've got some kind of management responsibilities, read his material, is because he deals with this human aspect of management. You must have discipline for an organization to succeed, but if you treat the people around you right, if you're fair, you'll do better. The military knows this instinctively. They have to, because life and death is concerned. But one of the things I noticed in the Army during difficult times is this tremendous culture of being supportive. You do what you can to support your men and women, and they will rally around you when you really need them. Mm-hmm. I ran the World Trade Center organization in Chicago for 2 years. I'm glad I did. I got hired, not because I'm so talkative, but because they were in some serious financial trouble. They were about to go, and I'd worked for 20 years at a strong and successful organization, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. I'm very proud of the fact that we worked together to turn it around. Nobody was fired. Some people did leave. We never missed a payroll. The first thing I did when we finally got some cash, beyond just keeping the creditors away, was to get in liability insurance, which we by law had to have and didn't have health insurance. After 6 months, everybody got a raise, but me. I was paid better than other people, and the place was so troubled, I insisted on 6 months' salary before I took the job as an advance. Everybody got a raise but me. I didn't broadcast that, but I didn't have to, and you could see the morale improving.
Mm.
Also, when you don't fire people who have been living in fear, and they obviously had institutional loyalty, it's amazing what they'll do for you.
Mm.
In corporate America, collectively, I think it may be changing some, but the movement away from these facts of life since the 50s and 60s has been really profound.
Right.
It really is immoral at some level.
Well, it's such short-sighted, short-term thinking, and often not thinking about the bigger picture and the greater good. Well, on that profoundly philosophical note, we have to draw this conversation to a close, but I'm glad we had a chance to really touch on a whole lot of different things, and look forward to your visit in the merry month of May, Professor Sear.
Well, it's because you're a great philosopher, Professor Berg, and a great musician.
Well, thank you.
You compose in all kinds of areas.
Well, appreciate you being here. Glad we could have this conversation today. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. And Marx and Freud also, thank you.
Professor Art Sear, Director